Elizabeth Whitfield was born Elizabeth Edwards. She was married to Thomas Whitfield, and they had seven children, and the seventh child was George. But you haven't come here to learn about Whitfield's mother. You've come here to learn about Whitfield's wife, Elizabeth Whitfield. So that's two Elizabeths, and Elizabeth was the name of the woman he first proposed to. He seems to have had a thing about Elizabeths. Elizabeth Delamotte received a proposal via her parents, and Whitfield wrote to her parents asking for her hand in marriage and saying, if you think it's suitable, please pass on the enclosed letter. And he said in the letter to her parents, I bless God, if I know anything of my own heart, I am free from that foolish passion which the world calls love. I write only because I believe it is the will of God that I should alter my state. But your denial will fully convince me that your daughter is not the person appointed by God for me. And so then we have the letter that was written to her, in which he, in essence, says, I need a housekeeper, I need a matron for my orphan house in Georgia. Are you prepared to marry me in order that you can be that housekeeper? And he goes on into long sentences saying there's all these hardships and all these depredations you would have to go through in order to achieve this. And not surprisingly, she turned him down. It is said that the concept of romantic love was something that developed as part of the Enlightenment during the 18th century, and arranged marriages and formal marriages were not that uncommon. But these days we have more of the Hollywood concept of love that seems to have developed from the Enlightenment, and so it was not because I thought she would make a wonderful housekeeper that I married my wife. She's pleased to hear me say that. So let me tell you about Whitfield's wife, Elizabeth James. According to Gillies, Whitfield's first biographer, her maiden name was Burnell. But Mrs. Bynon, who did some research in the 20th century, published in 1943, she says that Gillies was wrong, and in fact her maiden name was Gwynne. Which is interesting because Charles Wesley married Sarah Gwynne, the daughter of Marmaduke Gwynne, but I don't know, I haven't been able to find out if there is any family relationship between them or it's just a common name. Perhaps I should add, I am no relation to the South Wales Jameses, so I'm not giving this paper because I am in any way related to her. We do know that at the time of the marriage, she had a daughter by her first marriage by the name of Nancy. We know that she was being courted by Thomas Lewis, so that suggests she was mid to late teens at the least, and that by the time of the marriage, she had been settled in Bristol. And I have not been able to find any reference to her in any of Whitfield's letters. It seems as far as Whitfield was concerned, she had disappeared off the face of the earth. Perhaps if we were to have some of the private letters that were exchanged between Whitfield and his wife, there might be references to her. But in the ones that have been published and the ones that have subsequently been discovered, there is nothing about her at all. She was converted about 1738, a few years before she met Whitfield. Whitfield did meet her in Abergavenny. Some people pronounce it Abergavenny. But most people in England and most of the Welsh people I know pronounce it Abergavenny. She was also met by Wesley when passing through the area. He referred to her as a godly and a serious woman. There is a letter that suggests that she had poor eyesight. And she says in one letter that her reputation in the eyes of the world had gone down considerably because she had become a follower of Howell Harris. There was at one point an attempt to legally acquire her home. A writ was taken out against her, but that was overcome and she retained her home. Nancy was at some point converted before the wedding. There is reference to her round about the middle of 1741. And it was round about that time that she and Howell Harris were corresponding and they were discussing marriage. Should they get married? Or should they completely break it off and never have anything more to do with each other? At the same time, Hal Harris seems to have had an interest in Anne Williams, who in fact he did later marry. But he was struggling. He had this strange idea, which was common with most of the Methodists, that really you shouldn't marry. Really, if you married, then you would have troubles, it would be problems, you wouldn't be able to do all the things you should do. Because of their very methodical lives, getting up at 4 a.m, reading the Bible for X number of hours, prison visiting and all the other things, very structured during the day, it does make it rather difficult to have a family life. And also, both Whitfield and Harris thought, if I get married, will I be able to preach as much as I have done in the past? So Whitfield had proposed to Elizabeth Delamott in spite of this, which I think shows something of the affection that he had for her. But then when he came back from America and he was in Scotland in 1741, he and Howell Harris corresponded and Harris thought, here is a solution to my problem. I can, depends on how you want to phrase it, I can get rid of this problem I've got, this woman, or I can help her. Because I know she wants to marry me, but I can't. So therefore, we'll deal with this in this way. I'll hand her over to Brother Whit. And that's how he expressed it. There was correspondence between Whitfield and Elizabeth. And he proposed. Her response was that, well, I'm already spoken for, Hal Harris. So Harris had to say, no, that's okay. I give you up. She was not happy with this. She wrote to him, if you were my own father, you had no right of disposing me against my will. You say the thought of parting with her the Lord had made as your own soul was cutting till the Lord let you see eternity. It goes on. You can't do this to me. But Whitfield had by this time arrived and there was discussion. And after about 4 days, she thought, I'm never going to marry Harris. Whitfield seems a nice man. He looks like he'll look after me. He's famous. He's handsome. Don't be put off by the pictures of him later in life where he's rather bloated. He was, in fact, very slim at this time. So she decides, okay, I will marry him. And so they then have to trot round South Wales to find someone who's prepared to marry them. Such was the antipathy towards Methodism at the time. And so they get married on the 14th of November in a small chapel of ease near Caerphilly, where the cheese comes from, in South East Wales. I mentioned Caerphilly specifically because if you read Harry Stout, he says that they were married in Abergavenny. But then a man who also says that Whitfield was born in Bristol doesn't give you much confidence in his historical understanding. Whitfield was born in Gloucester. There were at the time rumours that Elizabeth was a wealthy woman. She wasn't. She had a house, a cottage, and she had some furniture, but not for long because Whitfield sold it. Possibly there were other suitors who were relatively wealthy, and it's because of these potentially wealthy suitors that people thought, therefore, she must have money. But she didn't. The odd thing is that after the wedding, Howell Harris gave her away at the wedding. Within a few weeks, he was writing to Elizabeth saying, what do you think about Anne Williams? Do you think she'd make me a good wife? So Harris was strange. I mean, Harris was strange in lots of ways, even more so later on. There were continuing close ties between Harris and Elizabeth. They regularly corresponded until 1749 when Harris began to go off the rails, have some very funny ideas, and he broke off fellowship, or fellowship was broken off from him by Whitfield and Elizabeth, and most of the other evangelicals because of the strange views that he had. But in the meantime, they had corresponded on a regular basis. Writing to Gilbert Tennant some weeks after the wedding, Whitfield wrote to him of Elizabeth, "About 11 weeks ago, I married in the fear of God one who was a widow, about 36 years of age, and has been a housekeeper for many years." Housekeeper, perfect. "Neither rich in fortune nor beautiful as to her person, but I believe a true child of God, and would not, I think, attempt to hinder me in his work for the world. In that respect, I am just the same as before marriage. I hope God will never suffer me to say, I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come." So just what you need, someone who you can drag around anywhere and will never complain. Elizabeth was a spiritual woman. In this letter written in July 1742, he writes, "As soon as I read your letter, my wife said, 'Let us give thanks and pray.' Accordingly, we knelt down and we had very near access to the Father of Mercies on your behalf. At night, after our coming home, we did the same." So she was quite prepared to say, let's get down and pray. Let's do this. So she often prompted Whitfield to do things that we would all think, well, surely he did those things automatically. Well, perhaps she just thought quicker than he did. The marriage appears to be been quite a happy affair, at least in the early days. She wrote from Glasgow in August 1742 about the happiness that she had of being with Whitfield, and also commented that there were some people in Scotland who were complaining about the company she kept and the interest she had in the clothes that she wore. Perhaps they were just dour Scots. Initially, Elizabeth would travel everywhere with Whitfield, but soon travel proved difficult, and Whitfield began to realise a woman isn't like a man. Writing in November 1742, he says, "My wife now lies very weak. She was tossed for 10 days in her voyage from Scotland to London. The ship was in imminent danger, but the Lord gave her much of his presence, and I trust she will be ready shortly for another voyage." So she's got terribly seasick just coming down the English coast, and now he's thinking, let's take her off to America. Well, they did go to America and went to Bethesda, and she found the heat somewhat exhausting. Now, I don't know about you, but I thank God for air conditioning. The times that I've been to Bethesda, I've thought it's a lovely place, but standing outside, it feels like I'm in a sauna. I can't cope with heat. My wife wanted to go and be a missionary in Nigeria, and I said, not if you marry me. In 1743, she became pregnant with their first child. And a few weeks before the birth, Whitfield wrote this: "My wife has been in trying circumstances, partly through the unskillfulness of a chaise driver, horse and trap, that sort of thing. I mean myself. Being advised to take her out into the air, I drove her as well as myself through inadvertence into a ditch. Finding that we were falling, she put her hand across the chaise, and thereby preserved us both from being thrown out." You do get the impression that physically he was a bit of a wimp. It should have been him protecting her. "The ditch might be about 14 feet deep, but blessed be God, though all that saw us falling cried out that we are killed, yet through infinite mercy we received no hurt. The place was very narrow near the bottom, and yet the horse went down as though let down by a pulley. A standerby ran down and catched hold of its head to prevent its going downwards. I got up upon its back and was drawn out by a long whip." Hang on. "Whilst my wife, hanging between the chaise and the bank, was pulled up on the other side." George, why weren't you helping her out? "Being both in a comfortable frame, I must own to my shame that I felt rather regret than thankfulness in escaping what I thought would be a kind of translation for our wished-for heaven." In spite of this, a few weeks later, their son John was safely delivered, while Whitfield was 100 miles away preaching. This, of course, was the story of their life. Whenever there was anything important in Elizabeth's life, where's George? Oh, he's here, there, everywhere, preaching. She got used to this. He writes, when he'd returned to London, upon retiring to my lodgings, news was brought me that God had given me a son. Thus I hastened to London, where I now am. And John was then baptized at the Moorfields Tabernacle in London. But George was poor. George could not afford the lodgings. George said, you've got a cottage in Abergavenny. Let's send you there. So off they go, and they get as far as Gloucester. And they're staying at the Bell Inn. And while staying at the Bell Inn, John sadly died. So what happens? Well, of course, there's a funeral. But what happens before the funeral? As the funeral bell is tolling, George is preaching. Why wasn't he sitting with Elizabeth, comforting her in her grief? And I think George was just one of those people who can't cope with so much emotion and so deals with it in the best way he can by preaching. She was to have several more pregnancies. Writing to Howell Harris from America in 1746, she says, shall I never have a line again? For I never expect to see you again, for in 16 months, I have had 4 miscarriages, which has brought me very low. I was given over last 21st of December by 2 doctors, but the Lord has once more brought me about. The last of these miscarriages took place towards the end of August 1746, Whitfield writes on the 26th of August. My dear wife would send you a few lines, but she is weak by reason of a miscarriage about 4 days ago. Later on, during their stay in America in 1748, Whitfield is unwell and he's advised to go to what was then called the Bermudas, what we would now call Bermuda. And so he went, and we have his journal from his time in Bermuda, where there is no mention of his wife because he'd left her behind. And after his time in Bermuda, he thinks, things are going on back in England, I'd better go back to England. First ship appears going to England, he jumps on, off he goes, sends a message to Elizabeth, come when you can. So this is amazing. You think, this is not the way to treat a wife. But that's what Whitfield did. And so he arrives in London, and it's about 9 months later when Elizabeth finally arrives, because she's not prepared to travel during the winter, and she gets to London in June. And so we have Whitfield's letters through 1750. I am now waiting every day for my wife's being... sorry, we're jumping ahead. He comments about how he's expecting his wife constantly, and there are several letters. She's coming any day. She's going to arrive any moment, and she doesn't. But eventually it's in June. Mid-June 1749, they're together again. In 1750, she's pregnant again. I now wait every day for my wife's being delivered of her present burden, and hope ere long to rejoice that a child is born into the world. Oh, that it may be born again and made an heir of the Redeemer's kingdom. That's October 1750. Another one a few days later saying the same sort of thing. Great anticipation about the birth of a new child. However, you never hear anything again about a birth. We can only assume that it was a stillbirth. A live birth, dying at 4 months, 4 miscarriages, 1 stillbirth. I know someone who had 1 miscarriage about 35 years ago. And when she mentioned it to me a few months ago, she just burst into tears. 35 years after 1 miscarriage. What must this poor woman have felt like after this? With all these traumas, she didn't travel with Whitfield anymore. She remained at the Tabernacle House next to the Moorfields Tabernacle in central London. Her health was never that wonderful ever afterwards. Whitfield would go off to America, Whitfield would travel around Britain, but she was never to be with him again on those travels. She is mentioned frequently in his letters. He does speak about my dear wife. He speaks about my fellow pilgrim. Various expressions of affection for her. But obviously with all this incessant travel on his part and leaving her behind, a coldness must have come upon the marriage. She did carry out a lot of correspondence. Sometimes she would write on his behalf when he was ill. Sometimes she would make copies of his letters. And she would also carry out extensive correspondence with people in South Wales, especially Howell Harris, informing them of the progress of the gospel. So she was a woman who was concerned about the gospel, concerned about the spread of the gospel, but physically she was just unable to go with him. When Whitfield was in Scotland in July 1768, he wrote letters and said, "I assume my wife is well because I've heard nothing from her." He returns to London on the 3rd of August when she was struck with an inflammatory fever. And 6 days later, she died. Whitfield preached her funeral sermon on the 14th of August from Romans chapter 8, verse 30. "But the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected to the same in hope." She was buried in the crypt of the Tottenham Court Road Chapel, and that's where Whitfield planned to be buried as well, were he to die in Britain. The inscription on her grave says, or said, "In memory of Mrs. Elizabeth Whitfield, aged 62, who, after upwards of 30 years' strong and frequent manifestations of a Redeemer's love, and as strong and frequent strugglings with the buffetings of Satan, bodily sicknesses, and the remains of indwelling sin, finished her course with joy, August the 9th, Anno Domini 1768. There you think the story might end, and you might be aware that in 1945, the last V2 rocket bomb to land on central London landed right on top of the Tottenham Court Road Chapel, and it was blown to smithereens. And I had thought that that meant that all those interred there had their bones scattered all over that part of London. I was wrong. I have subsequently discovered that at the end of the 19th century, the Tottenham Court Road Chapel was falling down. So they decided to take it down and build a new one, and it's the new one that was destroyed. And what they did with the burials was they moved them to North London, to the Chingford Mount Cemetery, and she is buried at the back of the cemetery. The cemetery, if you talk to many people in London, they'll say, "Oh yes, that's where the Cray twins are buried." The Cray twins, notorious 1960s gangsters, Reggie and Ronnie. And I forget which one was mad, but one of them ended his life in an asylum for the criminally insane, and the other one died in an ordinary prison. If you want to know the exact location, I can give that to you. I'm going to finish by asking an assessment of the marriage. It has been assumed by many that the marriage was not a good one on the basis of three quotes. Robert Southey, in his Life of John Wesley, said that the marriage was not a happy one. John Berridge said that Whitfield and Wesley should never have married, but that God had blessed them with a brace of ferrets. Berridge was a lifelong bachelor. And the Wesley marriage was definitely not a good one. But I do not believe that he is accurate. Cornelius Winter, who lived with the Whitfields for the last year of Elizabeth's life, wrote, "He was not happy in his wife, but I fear some who had not all the religion they professed contributed to his infelicity. He did not intentionally make his wife unhappy. He always preserved great decency and decorum in his conduct towards her. Her death set his mind much at liberty. She certainly did not behave in all respects as she ought. She could be under no temptation from his conduct towards the sex, for he was a very pure man, a strict example of the chastity he inculcated in others. As I mentioned, he would often in his letters, when writing to the about her, mention how happy they were together in the early part of the marriage. Talks about my wife, my dear wife, my fellow pilgrim, my yoke fellow. But once she ceased to travel with him, the relationship could never be as warm as it was before. Writing a week after her death, Whitfield wrote, "Let us work whilst it is day. The late, very unexpected breach is a fresh proof that the night soon cometh when no man can work. Pray, where may I find that grand promise made to Abraham after Sarah's death? May it be fulfilled in you whilst your Sarah is still alive. Sweet bereavements when God himself fills up the chasm." I think that suggests that he did miss her, that he was, to any degree that he could be, heartbroken by his loss. 7 months later, he wrote, "I feel the loss of my right hand daily, but right hands and right eyes must be parted with for him who ordereth all things well." Some people think that that just means, oh, I've got no one to copy my letters anymore. I think there's more to it than that. I think he was referring to the loss of intimacy of a beloved wife and not merely a scribe and housekeeper. In his funeral sermon, I mentioned from Romans 8:20, he referred to an incident showing her fortitude. We've always already seen what she was like going into a ditch. "Do you remember my preaching in those fields by the old stump of a tree? The multitude was great and many were disposed to be riotous. At first I addressed them firmly, and then, but when a desperate gang drew near, with the most ferocious and horrid imprecations and menaces, my courage began to fail. My wife was then standing behind me as I stood on the table. I think I hear her now. She pulled my gown and looking up said, 'George, play the man for your God.' My confidence returned. I spoke to the multitude with boldness and affection. They became still, and many were deeply affected." In a letter written from on board ship in 1744, he writes of an incident where they thought they were being attacked by enemy ships. "We sailed very comfortably on till we were again alarmed with the sight of two ships making up to us with all the sail they could crowd, and which our captain took to be enemies. The preparations for an engagement to me, who you know am naturally a coward, were formidable. My wife, after having dressed herself to prepare for all events, set about making cartridges." Very practical woman. "Whilst the husband wanted to go into the holds of the ship, hearing that was the chaplain's usual place." Yes, he was a coward. She clearly wasn't. But happily, in the circumstances, the approaching ships proved to be friends. Given the nature of Whitfield's ministry, with his punishing schedule, John Berridge was probably right in saying he should not have married. Whitfield gave every appearance of being a Henry Higgins. Why can't a woman be more like a man? He seemed incapable of coping with the different emotional and physical being of women, and he expected Elizabeth to obediently follow him everywhere. But Elizabeth did seek, as well as she was able, to be that dutiful wife. She was no limp lettuce of a woman, but showed courage and strong-mindedness in standing for principles, and hence the big falling out she had with Hal Harris, who complained that she was too strong-minded. This long-suffering woman should be better remembered for her dutiful support for her husband than has thus far been the case.